Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a hotel employee opens a sealed door and discovers an intriguing clue about Phoenix's not-so-distant past.
And the dangers teens face from AI companion tools.
But first, a pair of Arizona properties has landed on the most recent list of America's 11 most endangered historic places. This comes as both as federal funding for historic preservation is in question, and Arizona preservationists will gather later this week in Phoenix for their annual conference. Phoenix's Mystery Castle and Flagstaff May Hicks Curtis Home are both on the most endangered historic places list. And while this may sound like a problem, our next guest actually thinks it's a good thing. Catherine Leonard is Arizona State Historic Preservation Officer. She joins me to talk more about this. And Catherine, let's start with the fact that you've been quoted as saying you're excited about these properties making this list, which seems honestly a little counterintuitive.
I know we always laugh about that every time we see the 11 most endangered come out. Myself and other SHPOs, we're vying for these properties. We want the most endangered to be in our states. And it is counterintuitive, Mark, because, when a property is endangered, generally speaking, the level of care of the property has deteriorated to the point where we're looking at a total loss. That's never a good thing for historic preservation. But when it's recognized by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, you have that added layer of not only is this property in jeopardy of being a total loss, but this property is recognized at a national level as a must-save property. So for preservationists, there's nothing more than we like than good marketing and good press. And the 11 most endangered list really has proven itself to be a catalyst for investment in properties such as these.
Okay, so let's talk about the two Arizona locations on this list. First is the May Hicks Curtis House in Flagstaff. And this house basically belonged to Arizona's version of Betsy Ross, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know who was the first to coin May Hicks as the Betsy Ross of Arizona, but I know that Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, who is only a little bit obsessed with this project, has been running around the state with the Arizona 250 Commission talking about the May Hicks House and Betsy Ross of Arizona. Her family owned a boarding house in the south side of Flagstaff, right along Route 66. And her house was in back of the boarding house. And it's a very modest structure, what we would call a four square structure. And her husband apparently had made some commitments that his wife could sew. And he designed the flag from all accounts, and May Hicks sewed the flag.
Well, and so the other location I think will be familiar to a lot of folks here in the Valley, the Mystery Castle here in Phoenix. And I guess, like, what kind of state is that in? What kind of state is the May Hicks Curtis House? Like, are these in particularly bad shape and really at risk of being lost?
Well, the nature of the threats to the two properties are very different. The case with the May Hicks Curtis House is a threat of redevelopment. So this area, the south side of Flagstaff, is an area that is currently plagued by some really serious drainage issues. So there's a good deal of public works projects going on there. And this property, although it is in fair to good condition, is just quite simply in the way. Mm. So its preservation is really contingent on finding an appropriate place for it to be. And it's in satisfactory enough condition that it's already up on blocks and ready for a move. In the case of the Mystery Castle, this is a very unique property. This is a truly one-of-a-kind art piece. The threats to Mystery Castle are really not just deterioration. They are vandalism threats. And so this is really a property that is looking for stewardship.
So you mentioned that part of the benefit for properties that are on this list is that it, you know, brings them attention, maybe brings them some resources to help bring them back to where they need to be. Given where we are right now in terms of the amount of federal available resources to do stuff like this, Are those resources still around? Like, where are you looking to get money to do what needs to be done for these places?
You know, the public are often calling my office, or they'll call like a city historic preservation office when they see a building that they see is in need of care, and they want to see a preservation solution applied. But the truth of the matter is that some of our biggest success stories in preservation happen really with the support of private dollars from either foundations, non-for-profits, or even from public fundraising. And the 11 most endangered, the reason why we as SHPOs love to see ourselves or our properties on the 11 most endangered list is because it really does the job of bringing to light these important properties that for whatever reason have not been able to garner public money and in the form of government funding. We had some real success in historic preservation with ARPA grants a few years back, but those grants have all been expended. And ARPA grants saved quite a few properties in Arizona, like Camp Naco down in Naco, Arizona, which was also an 11 most endangered as well. But you know, soon after getting that ARPA funding that initially kickstarted the preservation, the Mellon Foundation was quick to come in with an additional $7 million of funds to help program Camp Naco. And that's what we're looking at here, is we're looking to basically find a group. It's almost like making a match, a love match. a group that is so enamored of the building that they just can't see a future for Phoenix without it. And I don't want to have any spoilers, but there are a couple groups that have come forward and a couple of discussions that have already occurred just this week with regards to the announcement. So I'm feeling really optimistic for both properties.
Do you think this is the future of historic preservation, that there will be less and less government funding to help do this and relying more and more on private or philanthropic funding?
Well, you are asking the state historic preservation officer about the future of preservation that does not involve the government. Ugh,
sorry.
That kills me. It's okay. It's okay. I would be lying if I didn't say we're in some pretty scary times in historic preservation. The National Historic Preservation Act was established in 1966, and its primary intent was to provide a sense of orientation to the American people. The idea being that you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And the National Historic Preservation Act was groundbreaking in that it established that the government has a role in ensuring that the people of the United States have that basic human right of orientation. So I think there is absolutely a need for public funding or federal funding of historic preservation. Unfortunately, we have seen just in the last weeks, some unfortunate news about appropriations of the Historic Preservation Fund, which is the main source of federal funding for state historic preservation offices and also for tribal historic preservation offices. The president's executive budget for fiscal year 26 has zeroed out all of the funds that go toward SHPOs and TIPOs, as we call them. So I am concerned. I am very concerned. And we are monitoring the situation.
All right. That is Catherine Leonard, State Historic Preservation Officer for Arizona. Catherine, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Tucked away in a narrow gorge, 2,000 feet below the rim of the Grand Canyon, sits the tiny town of Supai, the only village on the reservation of the Havasupai tribe. It is hard to get there. You can pretty much only do it on foot, which requires hiking a steep 8-mile trail full of switchbacks. As a result, getting mail in and out of Supai is no easy feat. But Charlie Chamberlain, who's lived in Supai for over 50 years, and his nephew, Nate, have a system. As Atlantic writer Sarah Yeager recently told me, the process involves a pack of mules and a whole lot of patience.
Every morning, starting around 8 a.m., Nate will come up to the post office with his string of mules and load up with the day's mail and strike out on the trail heading up to the top of the canyon.
How many mules are it? Is it?
It's usually about 5 mules who are carrying the mail and then a mule or horse that Nate uh-huh. himself is riding. So they ride all the way up to the top. And once there, a driver meets them at the trailhead and picks up the mail that they're carrying to drive it to the next closest post office, which is something like 70 miles away in the town of Peach Springs. And also at the trailhead, they pick up the mail that has come in from Peach Springs, load it up on the mules, and head back down. And that whole journey up and down is 16 miles, takes about 6 hours, and they do it 5 days a week.
And just for the visual on this, where is the mail? Is it like strapped? Are there bags strapped to the mules?
Yeah, so there are pack saddles on the mules, you know, sort of wooden structures to which they can lash with ropes. You've probably seen, like, if we work in an office building, you might have seen those kind of opaque plastic USPS crates that are
right.
open yeah. at the top. They use those in Supai too for mail delivery, but they just lash them to the side of a mule.
There is this wonderful part in the story where Charlie Chamberlain talks to you about this often quoted piece of Postal Service lore about how there's this mandate to deliver the mail in all conditions. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night shall prevent the Postal Service worker from completing their appointed rounds. But as you write, the Chamberlains and the other folks that they work with, they have to deal with all of that and then some.
That's right. You know, I live in Brooklyn in New York. And when you're thinking about bad weather, you know, it might be kind of a bad rainstorm. When you're talking about delivering mail into the Grand Canyon, you're dealing with switchbacks. You're dealing with rattlesnakes. You're dealing with flash floods.
Some of these floods can be like 7 feet of water can come rushing in kind of out of nowhere, right?
Yeah. Charlie told me a story about once being on the trail with his mules and the floodwaters started rising, he was able to get sort of up and out of the way. He could tell they were really high, but it wasn't until the next day when he was coming back up the trail, he could see from the water lines on the rock that the water would have been over his head, even on horseback.
Wow. I think this is something you talked to Charlie about, that there is this helipad in the town of Supai. But they still do this via mule train rather than via helicopter.
So Charlie said that the reason that the mules have persisted is that they're really the most reliable way to get the mail into Supai. The helicopters are seasonal, so they run a few days of the week, but more during the warmer months, sort of corresponding to tourism. But they're also very sensitive to certain weather. So it gets really windy on the top of the canyon. If there are high winds, helicopters aren't necessarily able to land. But the mules can go up and down, as we were talking about before, in reference yeah. to the motto, in all kinds of weather. And so, you know, if you're counting on a delivery and the mules carry things like lab work for the clinics, like things that where there can be some real urgency to things moving in and out of the community, you can count on a mule.
Yeah. One of the other things that's really amazing about this piece is that in addition to it being this remarkable story about Supai, is this is also a story about the Postal Service, which I didn't realize until I read the piece actually predates the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, the postal system was founded in 1775, so it's older than the country itself. And, you know, the idea that really animated the post office was having a way for colonies to be able to communicate even before there was an official United States.
One of the other really memorable lines from the piece is a reference to one of the Postal Service's stated mandates, which is to, quote, render postal service to all communities.
That's right. I mean, you can look at Supai as sort of, I think I write in the piece, perhaps the most extreme iteration of that mandate. Since the founding of the Postal Service, the idea of it being for all Americans has really been an essential part of the service.
So one of the other things that you're writing about in this piece, and that is something of a backdrop to it, is the fact that President Trump, in both his first term and his second, has periodically made noise about making drastic changes to the Postal Service in one way or another, which are often couched in the idea that he doesn't like that the Postal Service is not profitable. But am I right that part of what you're doing with this piece is making the case that what the Postal Service does should not necessarily be measured in purely economic terms?
You know, I bought a postcard while I was there to send to my husband and my son, and it cost 56 cents. And I think there's just about no way that that postcard paid for itself, given the journey it needed to follow. But there's a lot of concern among advocates for the Postal Service that privatization would mean less service and more expensive service, especially for rural communities, just given that there are a lot of rural areas where, you know, there's fewer customers, longer distances to deliver the mail. If you're purely looking at mail delivery as a profit exercise, it's not clear that places like this would be able to enjoy the service that they have now.
Right. Well, in closing, Sarah, I wanted to ask, would you be willing to read just the last graph of your piece?
Sure, I'd be glad to. The Postal Service reflects the nation's founding vision to create a country both expansive and united. Supai has seen the worst of that vision. But the mules, unbothered by politics as they trod up and down the canyon, still carry with them a reminder of what America promised to be.
Well, Sarah Yeager is deputy executive editor at The Atlantic and wrote this wonderful piece called How the Most Remote Community in America Gets Its Mail. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Social AI companions are becoming more popular, but researchers with a group that advocates for kids and teens say the platforms are not appropriate for anyone younger than 18. Among Common Sense Media's findings, it's not difficult to get around age restrictions. Advice that could be harmful is not uncommon, and that the line can easily be blurred for teens between what is real and what isn't. Danny Weiss is chief advocacy officer at Common Sense Media. I spoke with him earlier and asked if anyone has a sense for how common it is for kids and teens to be using these companion AI programs.
Well, the AI companion tools are definitely new, but they're already being picked up quite quickly. There are millions of users on some of these sites that are not very well known. And one of the problems is that sometimes kids and teens know about them before parents or other adults know about them.
Do you find that kids tend to find out about them because maybe they have used something like ChatGPT in school or with friends or something like that, and this sort of seems like a natural next step?
It is, in a way, it's a natural next step. Our earlier research found that kids are adopting AI fairly quickly for homework and social purposes, and that parents did not have nearly as much awareness about AI as the kids did. And then once you become comfortable with AI, you can sort of start to explore and see what else is out there.
One of the things I found particularly interesting with Common Sense Media's findings here is that even for some of the services, the platforms that have restrictions in place to prevent kids younger than a certain age from using them, you found that those restrictions are pretty easy to get around.
Yeah, that was a really important finding. A number of the companies, Character.ai in particular, likes to say that they have robust safeguards in place. I believe they're quoted publicly as saying, even if it's not perfect, they're always working to make it better. There's no reason why we should be racing to have these applications available to kids and then knowingly put them in front of something that's dangerous.
Is there really, in your mind, a way to allow adults to use these kinds of platforms, or people who, you know, just generally are maybe more emotionally ready to use them and have them available where kids can't get access to them and do the kinds of things on them that are potentially detrimental to them?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it is definitely a challenge. We're not naive about that. So there's two things going on at the same time here. One is that social AI companions are, of course, available to anyone on the internet. And there are a number of lawmakers, and we're working closely with them, who are concerned also for the general user population. They believe all social AI companions should have more transparency about, for example, the fact that you are talking to a machine. You are not talking to a human being, so you'd get a constant reminder about that. And also for any kind of flags. If somebody's talking to an AI companion and says, I'm feeling really down, I think I might kill myself, then that AI companion should be required to send a signal to an appropriate authority. That doesn't exist today. So that's for adults and for kids. But for kids themselves, we just to clarify, after we did our risk assessment, we made a determination that no one under the age of 18 should be using these. And then you get into the question of how do you know who's under 18 and how you don't? And that's a very important question.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a question that a lot of platforms, not just AI platforms, but social media platforms and others are really kind of struggling to get their hands around.
It is it's a topic that's called age verification or age assurance. It's an incredibly complicated and vitally important problem to solve, which is how do you get around the way it's done today? Today, if somebody goes online and they ask for your age, you type in, I'm 18 or I'm 21, and most of the sites say, thank you for giving me your age, and that's it. So that's called self-attestation. That doesn't really work. And we know that most companies, based on all of the data that they've collected, have a pretty good idea of who their users are and know what their real ages are. So, on the one hand, companies can know already that they're serving an underage population when they shouldn't be, but they choose to serve them anyway because they make so much money off of it.
It seems like, based on your findings, that a lot of the potential harms to kids under 18 from these companion AI platforms are not dissimilar from a lot of the potential harms we see that kids face from social media platforms. I wonder if there are any that maybe seem a little more unique to this kind of platform than maybe other content they can get online.
Yes, that is a really good question. And I agree with you that there are similarities between what kids are facing with social media. One of the problems with social media is the sheer amount of time that kids spend scrolling, clicking, dealing with likes, or not getting enough likes on something. You know, that's really a problem. But the thing with that's a little different with social AI companions is this issue of, are you dealing with a machine or a human? So there are a number of instances where in our research, we typed in questions and the answers were, I try to be as real as I can be, and I want you to think of me as being real. That kind of an answer from an AI companion in a lovely voice is really hard for a kid to resist, for a teenager to resist, and honestly, for many adults to resist. But that's what these companions are really trying to do. They're trying to play the role of a friend, so-called friend, when in fact they can't really distinguish between right and wrong. They're not really friends, and they're basically collecting lots and lots of information about the user to further train the AI to do even more.
So you mentioned that you're working with lawmakers on some of these issues. I wonder if the solution, at least in your mind, is one of policy, if it's one of technology, if it's something else or some combination of those?
I'm going to say that it's three things. There, we need three things to make the internet healthier and safer for kids and teens everywhere. Number one, we do need new public policy in place. So we need lawmakers at the state level and in Congress to adopt legislation to build safeguards and guardrails around both social media platforms and AI social companions. Some of that is already happening, but it's challenging to do it only at the state level. So we really also need Congress to get involved. So that's number one. Number two is parents and teachers and grandparents need to get better educated about the technology their kids are using, not to be judgmental of the kids, but to understand better what they're doing. And then the third thing is pressure on companies. Today, we're launching a petition that people can sign to call on Character.ai, Replica, and Nomi, three very unwell-known companies, to make sure that their products are not used by kids under 18.
All right. That is Danny Weiss, Chief Advocacy Officer with Common Sense Media. Danny, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Author and historian Robert Malikian wants Phoenix's future to look more like its past. In his new book, Forgotten Phoenix, or The Art of Hotel Management, Malikian takes readers back in time to a version of downtown Phoenix many of us wouldn't necessarily recognize. There's nonstop foot traffic, vintage architecture, shops and restaurants open all night long. And to hear Robert tell it, a happier, healthier existence for everyone who lives here. I spoke with Malikian last week about his vision for the new old Phoenix.
Being from New York, I love the hustle and bustle of people on the street interacting.
Yeah.
It's good for the city, good for people. So I wanted to carry that moving from New York City to Phoenix and save historic buildings, so they're very pedestrian oriented.
In New York, it seems like maybe just because of the pop cultural presence of it, it's hard to forget about the past.
And people are from there. Here, they're from somewhere else. So they have a loyalty to somewhere else, generally speaking.
Well, in this book, you're particularly focused on downtown Phoenix, right?
Correct.
Why focus on downtown specifically? Why use that as kind of a petri dish?
Downtown is the center of everything. For the first 90 years of Phoenix history, it was everything. Shopping, living, movies, bakery shops, ice cream parlors, restaurants, hotels. It was everything. And that's what Phoenix should go back to. And I wish they would reintroduce people to their wonderful center of downtown, not just sports, not just government, not just convention centers. It should be a day-to-day city, not a special event city. They've made these monolith, non-walkable buildings that have no shade. The test of a downtown success is people strolling.
Well, speaking of strolling, part of the origin story of this book is these night walks that you like to take. When did you start doing that? Tell me a little bit of the backstory there.
My father bought an old hotel in downtown Phoenix. And in that hotel, there was a sealed door that no one had known what that was from. So it must have been sealed in the late 50s, early 60s. We bought it in 1973, the hotel. So my father made us free labor, worked as teenagers in the hotel. And one day we said, Dad, can we bust through this? We'll see what's on the other side of this thing. Because at the bottom, it was like a step coming out. There could have been a staircase behind it. We busted through, and there was a staircase behind it.
Oh, my God.
It went up to a mezzanine from the 1920s that went along Central Avenue. We found a lot of paperwork, bills, ledgers.
How well preserved was it? I mean,
it was well preserved because it was sealed in the late 50s or early 60s, so from 1928 when it had opened. There was a matchbook there that represented 24-hour downtown Phoenix. It said a free meal if you find this cafe without a customer day or night with exclamation points after it. So it proudly and boldly claimed that downtown Phoenix was a 24-hour downtown, and they dare you to challenge that. And if you can find them without a customer, you get a free meal. So I walked in the middle of my graveyard shift, which was 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., at 3 in the morning when there was no business. I just get and walk the streets, dark and quiet. Imagine what the trolleys used to sound like, the canals, the horse and carriages, and go to this old coffee shop that was long torn down, unfortunately. And just imagine what it was like in the old days in downtown Phoenix. And that's I started studying 1920s downtown was when most of the seeds of downtown were planted.
So you find this matchbook and that prompts you to start taking these walks.
See downtown history by night and learn about it by day.
Right. And you're imagining these old scenes even as you're walking through newer Phoenix. What was that contrast like in those moments? Because it strikes me that the life inside your mind at that time and what you were actually seeing at 3 o'clock in the morning on the streets of Phoenix, there must have been, I'm imagining there was a contrast, but maybe it wasn't as wide a gulf as I'm guessing.
The historic buildings were still there, thank goodness. So I can imagine what activities, restaurants there used to be there, the Flame, the Grand, the American Kitchen, wonderful old places that drew people to the Fox Theater. People used to shop during the day, take their groceries to the theater, put it in a dumbwaiter to a cold storage, and spend the afternoon and evening watching movies. It was all downtown was all day affair. And that's what I would imagine walking around. Mm-hmm. One day we could get back to that.
That speaks to the word forgotten in the title of your book, this idea in the very spirit of it, that something is in danger of being forgotten. Is that a fair framing?
It very is, yes. And for 90 years, from 1870 to 1960, it was everything. Phoenix people loved Phoenix. It was there. They were born here generally. But since 1960, so the last 65 years, it's just been spread out very thinly to all these outlying areas. And people stay home and watch the streaming shows and there's just not the public interaction that it used to be.
Boy, there's such a contrast between that image of people sitting at home watching something on TV and you walking through the streets in the middle of the night running your own streaming show in your head.
Oh, absolutely. And I was way ahead. I was the richer for it. It's healthy. It's like being near the ocean or mountains or forests. Every historic building tells a tale. It's like a coded book. And if you take the time to read about it, you'll learn what the person's motivation was to build it. Was it out of the loss of a child like the Gruneau Clinic on McDowell? Was it out of a feeling of bravado like Dwight Hurd and the Hurd Building, tallest building in the state?
Is the Hurd Building the one that also has the old radio tower
Correct.
On top?
It used to. It moved over to the Westward Ho.
Uh-huh.
But that was he owned both newspapers at the time, and he was the king of Phoenix. He wanted to prove it by building the tallest building.
So he owned the Republic and
the Republican and the Gazette.
Uh-huh. And so he wanted to prove it by building these giant structures.
He was the king. He was the king. And then he ran for governor and lost, and then the Lures built their Lures building and took the title away as the tallest building.
And what's the story of this clinic that was built out of grief for lost
child? The Gruneau Clinic was parents whose daughter, I believe, was misdiagnosed. It was a horrible tragedy. And in the memory of their child, they built this beautiful building, 10th Street and McDowell, across from Good Samaritan Hospital. The detail work, the murals, it's just a piece of art just to walk through if you get a chance. Winnie Ruth Judd worked there. So it's a lot of Phoenix history.
Another great Phoenix historical story.
Right, right. So a lot of Phoenix history. If you search for it, you can decode these books and learn history, and it's really good for you.
I love this description that you gave a moment ago of treating life in the city almost the same way as you would a natural wonder, like a forest or a beach. And I heard somebody say once about experiences in nature that what's beautiful about them is they ask nothing of you. You just take yourself to them and it gives you this bounty of gifts. And the way you're describing life in a bustling downtown in a city with a rich history like Phoenix has, it strikes me that the same opportunity is available to you if you just go put yourself there.
You realize that you're part of something much bigger than you, which is a wonderful freeing feeling. Seeing the ocean, mountains, forests, downtowns, you realize that you're part of a connection to all life, all buildings, trees, everything. And it's a comforting feeling.
Well, that strikes me as something to remember. And we've been talking about the book Forgotten Phoenix or The Art of Hotel Management. I'm speaking to the author, Robert Malikian. And thank you, Robert, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.